Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Good evening. Welcome to Namaste Radio. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and I would like to say hello. I hope you are having a fantastic day, whether you're listening to this live or on podcast. Thank you for joining and sharing your energy with us this evening. I would love to invite you to check out Namaste Publishing's global community site. It is free. And you can go to namastepublishing.com for blogs and discussions, a spiritual dictionary. There's tons of different interactive experiences to be had at namastepublishing.com. So please join us there as well. And tonight's guest is Reverend Mark Pope. He is the minister at the Unity Church in Sedona, Arizona. And he had a rough start to life, and I don't think that anyone can explain it better than him, so I'm just going to bring him right up. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Marie.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm great. I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
Good. Thank you so much. So we have lots of questions for you. I want to talk about what's going on now, but in order to bring us up to the here and now, can you start, tell us a little bit about your journey? You left home at 13.
Yes. Of course, I didn't have a great deal of wisdom or very much spiritual insight, if any, at that point. So most of the decisions I made were, you know, being made from an egoic or unconscious predicament. And out of a kind of a reaction to life, I spent the next 7 of 9 years, I guess it was, incarcerated in various institutions, detention homes and reform schools and locked psychiatric ward at one point and county jails. And eventually I did time in a maximum security unit of the Texas Penitentiary in 1969 and 70. And in 1971, I was arrested again for some drug charges where actually I was innocent of the charges, but my circumstance was didn't look good, I was threatened with a life sentence under $300,000 bond and spent that next 6 months locked up, and it's during that period that the beginning of spiritual light dawned on me, and a major shift occurred. Unlike, say, an Eckhart Tolle, in my case, it was not a permanent or complete shift at all, but it was significant enough to change the entire direction of my life from one of being, well, a criminal to one of spiritual interest. And I don't know how much of that story you feel your listening audience would be inclined to hear about. I could share a few of the details if you wish me to.
Well, I can imagine that I'm leaving home at 13, and you, I would guess you probably spent some time on the streets if you're fending for yourself literally as a child.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, my family kind of exploded. My sister eventually was diagnosed as schizophrenic. My brother became a lifelong heroin addict, and I temporarily became a criminal. And yet, you know, all of these events and circumstances ultimately get redeemed by the simple fact that they served ultimate awakening. So, yeah, I didn't I didn't know much, and I was just on a partially a survival. I was in a survival mode, but I was also had an innate sense of wanting to, you know, cross all boundaries and see, you know, what was possible in the world. I was kind of, there was a certain adventurousness to it all for me. It wasn't all just pain and misery.
Okay. So it sounds like you wanted to see where life was going to take you and live life on your own terms, it sounds like.
Yeah, I sort of rejected the values of the world. My perception was the world looked pretty crazy to me, and actually, from today's perspective, I'm not so sure I was wrong about that. How to deal with it was, you know, my choices in that regard were not the best, but in reaction to what looked like kind of a crazy world and around me, I decided that I couldn't really trust the values and the structures around me, so I ignored them, and eventually they clamped down on me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and so all of this kind of came to a head when you were in the penitentiary and you were facing a life sentence for a crime you didn't commit. What are you feeling in that moment?
Yeah, let me just give you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of the important components from a spiritual perspective. I wasn't in the penitentiary when that happened, but I had met a man in the penitentiary that caught my attention by virtue of a certain presence that he had about him. And some remarkable things happened in interaction with him. He later shared a story with me about having been arrested for crimes he hadn't committed and understanding that he was on a spiritual path and that the object or the curriculum in life was to undergo whatever life gave you to undergo in equanimity and without resistance. And he talked about being on a yoga path, etc. Well, I didn't really understand what all he was talking about, but it impacted me, and it set up the stage in a synchronistic way for the fact that I was about to undergo almost the same blueprint where I was arrested once more. I was working for a college professor and managing a nightclub and restaurant, and I had not committed any crime, but two of my employees possessed some drugs, and some search warrants were brought out, and I was arrested along with the other two. And because of my history, there was certainty on the part of the district attorney that I was guilty, and so he actually went on television and guaranteed me a life sentence, and I was held under $300,000 bond. And during that time, just previous to that, between the penitentiary and this event, I had done my best to make up my mind not to put myself back in those predicaments again and not to break the law. And so I was, now I'm in jail, looking like the end of my life. I'm innocent. And so a good deal of fear, as well as a lot of rage and resentment, rose up in me. I encountered a piece of literature that a lot of your listening audience, I'm sure, will be familiar with. It's kind of a classic these days, called As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. And it actually said in it, if you happen to be in the gaol or the almshouse, old English terms for jailhouse or poorhouse, at the time of this reading, then you were there by virtue of your attitudes, which have been created through seeds that you've sown in your own consciousness. And he went on to say that the most difficult of all states of consciousness, the one that always could be counted upon to result in lack, limitation, and bondage, is resentment. And when that book fell into my hands and I read it, I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, there's no other out for me. I wonder if it's possible that this might be happening because of resentment, because even though it wasn't one of your typical how-to books, I thought, I mean, I'm fairly bright, and right away I thought, well, if resentment put me in here, then, you know, perhaps if I could release the resentment, that might change my circumstance. And so I adopted a rather unsophisticated practice of forgiveness, in which I would bring up guards that had beaten me in reform school and girlfriends that had left me and my parents who I felt had either deserted or abandoned or, you know, not met my the needs of the little me, et cetera. And I would just sort of speak to them in my mind's eye, hiding, of course, the fact of what I was doing from those around me. I was at the time in a 100-man tank in a county jail in Houston, Texas, so you couldn't tell people around you that you were busy doing meditation and forgiving people. It wouldn't have been healthy. So I just hid it, and I would lay on my bunk. I had learned a little bit about meditation in my short time between the penitentiary and this event, so I was also practicing that. And I would just say to people, you know, I'm really sorry that I've blamed you. And, you know, I had done an inventory, Marie. I'd kind of looked inside myself to see how much resentment there might be in a sort of self-honest way. And the truth was I realized I didn't know anybody that had ever been very close to me that I didn't wind up having some resentment toward. I was more or less in a victim consciousness. From the perspective I lived in those days, pretty much everybody had done me wrong. So there was nobody that was of any import to me that I didn't need to do some forgiving toward. So anyway, one day I also was laying on my bunk doing this forgiveness and meditation, and I suddenly found my awareness located outside the physical body and personality structure, looking down on a body. And at first I didn't realize it was the body that I still live in here. I just saw a body, and then I looked a little closer and I realized it was the body that I live in. And then I could see the personality structure, the conscious mind, and it was laying there, you know, trying to forgive people. And there are really no words in this, but if there were words, they might have been that I realized that who and what I am, first of all, is not a body, and it's not a personality structure. And the personality structure that I had was doing the best it could to do the right thing. And so I felt sort of an unspeakable compassion and appreciation. And then suddenly I was back in my body looking up in the air. And bear in mind, I had no spiritual training, nor had I read anything other than this little book I'm talking about. So I didn't have a context for this, but I also didn't have the conditioning that a lot of people do. I had no religious conditioning. And so I looked up in the air, and I found myself trying to somehow figure out what had happened. And all I knew was that I felt somehow different and changed by it. And my attorney came to see me. There are only two more pieces of this that are significant enough to make the story complete. One is that up until now, I had a court-appointed attorney, and all I did was whine and cry and, you know, scream at him to go talk to so-and-so because I'm innocent. And this time when he came to see me, I remember saying to him that I realized that it's not his fault that I'm in this predicament, that it's my own fault, because I'd been arrested about 25 times, and it was no wonder nobody believed me, and that I wanted him to understand that no matter what the disposition of the case was, that I wouldn't blame him. And I remember him looking at me kind of shocked and saying, what happened? And I didn't try to explain what had happened. I couldn't. I just said, well, I said, I had a change of heart, and I realized the only thing I have left in life is my own integrity, and I can't waste it blaming other people anymore. And he said, well, that's wonderful. He said, I still don't have anything to prove your innocence, and the case still looks very tough. So I'm going to fast forward to the day of the trial and say that a jury had been picked. The district attorney had once again publicly announced his intention to ask for a life sentence. He had not been willing to do any plea bargaining or negotiating. He was actually, I think, using my case to build a political career. And they had been, they spent the first part of the day picking a jury. A jury had been picked. I was in a holdover cell just outside the courtroom waiting for the trial to begin that afternoon when I heard a gavel bang, and my lawyer came around the corner, and he said, he asked me, he said, "Are you ready to go home, Mark?" And I looked at him and I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I didn't want to tell you about this ahead of time because I didn't want to raise any hope. Wasn't sure how the judge would rule," he said, "but a few weeks ago I woke up in the middle of the night, I couldn't sleep, and I went into my office," and he said, "I happened to be looking at a certain law book, and I opened it rather randomly to a ruling by the Supreme Court that said that a search warrant, in order to be legal, required four items. It had to name the city, the state, the county, and a physical description or street address of the property to be searched." And he said, "With my caseload, I don't even know why you came to mind, but you did, and I pulled out your file and looked at the search warrant used to discover those drugs on that property, and it said River Road, Harris County, Texas. But," he said, it didn't name a city, and you were, there's a River Road in Channelview and a River Road in Houston, both in Harris County, and that made your search warrant technically illegal. Therefore, any incriminating evidence found through the use of it is not admissible. And I made a motion to dismiss that the search warrant be found to be illegal, and the judge ruled that it was. He realized that to go forward with the case, even though they might get a conviction, would eventually be reversed by the Supreme Court and was therefore a waste of the taxpayers' money. So all cases have been dismissed, and you're free to go.
Wow. And so this, what are you feeling?
Well, I mean, that's what lives me still, Marie. I mean, it's been further chapters of the same deepening realization, first of all, that we are not these bodies or these personality structures. And in my case, a prominent description or energetic to consciousness is unconditional love and compassion. That's what I think dissolved enough of the ego in me at that time to shift me as it did. The reason I felt like I had myself back after that jailhouse experience was, you know, my heart, you might say, opened. And it's clear to me that that there is such a thing as immediate and instantaneous grace. And it's also clear to me now that how badly we want it and how willing we are to be self-honest about what it is that's got us trapped are important components. Today we have, and I'm a big subscriber to Eckhart's teachings, some very clear teachings helping us recognize that the source of our suffering is identification with a little me. That by its very nature lives in poverty and fear. Even if it looks arrogant, its underlying tendrils or roots are in separation and therefore can't be anything but structures that produce suffering. So that was the beginning of my awakening to that. Now, I would have even your listening audience know that I, unlike Eckhart and some others, did not achieve some place where the ego dissolved. I fell after that into many, many more ego traps, even as a spiritual teacher, you know, where for a while I used to tell this story as if it was my story about me. And subtly, in a way, I was using it to build an ability to support myself as a spiritual teacher. And tonight, when I tell the story, I'm not interested in that at all. I'm using the story simply as a pointer to the possibility of phenomenal life-altering and transforming and awakening grace that I believe is always already right here, right now. It just requires the kind of motivation I had, where in that case I had no out. The only out I had was offered to me as a willingness to look and see if I might have in within me the very cause of my predicament, and I discovered that I did. And in that willingness to look, that awareness itself is, as Eckhart points out quite clearly, is awakening. And that energy that looks, that consciousness that looks and sees that, has, in my experience, a phenomenal kind of love to it, or appreciation, or mercy, or compassion. None of the words quite do it for me, but this is, I think, what finally lifts us into the ability to, you know, complete our awakening by continuing to look at what's unawakened in us still, or to serve in through relationships by holding others in the understanding that if their behaviors are distorted or egotistical or egoic, then it's simply because they're trapped in unconscious beliefs. It's not that there's anything bad about them inherently. They're just trapped in a place that, for the grace of God, I would still be trapped in. So that's the essence of where I attempt to serve from now.
So, Reverend Mark, I'm wondering, do you now try to help other people who are in that situation, kids with a troubled past or prisoners?
I do. I spent an hour on the phone today speaking to the parents of a young man who attempted suicide, a heroin addict who attempted suicide, speaking to them about what they could do, which is paradoxically and the opposite of human nature. I mean, anything you really try to do too much to help the young man at this point actually feeds back into the disease. I mean, all addictions are the same, whether it's alcohol or just being addicted to the light changing faster than you want it to. The source of it's the same, but you have to release him and let him be free to make whatever choice he wants to make. And that's not within their bailiwick or mine or anyone else's. We can encourage him. We can point to the fact that there is another way to live, but unless he can receive it, there's not much else that we can do. And that's a hard lesson to have to convey to parents, particularly to a mother. I think mothers have the most difficulty with that sort of thing. And, you know, we also have a clean and sober living house here in Sedona that I and some other friends of mine helped to bring into being, where individuals coming out of the addicted community, the recovery, coming into recovery can live very inexpensively and learn to get their feet back on the ground and move back into a more productive expression of life. So, yeah, I mean, it seems that I am often, and I'm, my business career was entirely devoted to turning around broken and losing businesses. As it matured, I became kind of a troubleshooting consulting manager, where I would go into a business and essentially release the people that weren't willing to hold a high vision of what was possible and transform the interior, that is the staff, into one of a group of people willing to care about and respect each other and show up on time and go 110% and then extend that kind of a behavior toward the customers. And then consciously trying to, that's been the nature of my work in churches, as I have, every church I've ever been sent to was troubled when I got there. Churches are a lot more difficult to turn around than businesses, because they're essentially their political structures. and you're not the boss. You're an employee that's hired by a board, so it takes more time and is more difficult. But we're attempting to see here at Unity of Sedona, is it possible to have a church actually be devoted to spiritual awakening rather than simply a kind of a, what I see is often the case, a half-dysfunctional family consciousness where we really look carefully at the spiritual principles and where good boundaries need to be, and being accountable to each other for, you know, telling the truth on ourselves and being self-honest and willing to look at our own, the popular word today is shadow, but really just the egoic structures that are still in us. And so far, so good. I never know. It's one day at a time. But we do have a successful church here, and we've done well in every respect, I think. And my model is, of course, not the model of some enlightened leader, because there's still ego in at work. Mine still dances around in there like a cat on a hot tin roof, and I occasionally get bitten by what Eckhart calls the pain body, and you know, I'm required, just like everybody else, to keep looking, and looking with, you know, compassion at, you know, the degree or extent to which conditioned consciousness, or even unconsciousness, might be motivating my words or my behavior, and then having the courage to confess that. And in this case, it often has to be done publicly. So I call it the model of the flawed leader, somewhat laughingly, but I mean, it's also partly true. I mean, I don't know any other way to play the role and still be honest.
Well, I just want to say thank you for being honest and being the flawed leader. So many of us feel like we can't teach or we can't lead until we've perfected our lives, and 99.99% of us are probably in this lifetime never going to be perfect, and that's what makes it so useful for us to help teach other people, is to show that even with our flaws, we can still do our best every day.
Yes. Well, you know, occasionally I'm called upon to do trainings for, you know, groups of chaplains or other spiritual teachers or leaders. And one of the things I like to say, Marie, about this is that my sense of it is that really all we have to do is check the intention. We may not can behave in a completely conscious, fully present way 24 hours a day. And yet, in our attempt to serve or teach or facilitate or present conferences or seminars, we can at least, you know, just say to ourselves before we step before others in that service, we can just say, well, you know, I'm going to do the best I can to be of value here, and trust what comes forth from that intention. It may not be perfect. It may be, you know, somewhat flawed, and yet I know in my heart of hearts that I wish to be and I want to be of service here. And that moves us, I think, pretty quickly. I mean, the ego might even still be there, but somehow I think what transmits itself through us is that relatively pure intention. And, you know, when I talk to chaplains that are learning how to pray for others, and I say, well, you know, the words don't mean anything. The words are just words, and they don't, you know, you may not be gifted with the gift of articulation. But if all you really mean to do is provide a space for people to be where they are and how they are without making them wrong, if you intend to transmit mercy and compassion and a high intention, then the essence of your communication, whatever comes through you, will be that, and it'll come out of the field, you know, the undivided presence that is the truth of who we are, and it'll still work for us. I think very few of us are have had the field cleared, as I think may be the case with a few. For example, I really love the book that Ajahn Shanti has recently written called The End of Your World, by which he means the end of our perception of a separated world. It means the dissolving of the sense of separation, and the place that he speaks of it from is still a place that's deeper than I think I can yet imagine. And they're just, but they're not relatively few people for whom that seems to have fully occurred. And the rest of us, and still, and I wonder sometimes if it isn't true that we need individuals that are still, you know, wounded healers or flawed teachers who confess that fact while we're working, so that it communicates to people, look, we don't have to be perfect to be of value to each other, which is what you were saying to start with, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree, because one of the frustrations that I've had in my own spiritual journey is looking up to people who seem to have found this enlightenment, and it's just there all the time, and it, at least what they present to the world seems to be like everything's all good all the time. And it's really hard to relate to that.
Yes, I think it is. I think a good pointer on that one is, however, that if that arises in our awareness, if a teacher, which is an image, really, an awareness. I mean, in a real way, there is no outer Eckhart Tolle or Ajahshanti or anybody else. These are just teachings that are vibrating at a very high level that seem to be streaming through an instrument. But they rest in our awareness when we're looking at their book or watching the DVD. And so they're really images arising in us. They're not even out there. They're in the field of our own awareness. So the first thing is to realize there's no need to project, looking at them as if they're some separate perfected being is already essentially looking at it wrong. They are part of us. They are in us. They are an aspect of us all. And so we don't need to worship them. We just need to appreciate the fact that part of the consciousness of humanity, of our shared being, has awakened and is resting here in our awareness, transmitting greater awakening to us. So there's no up or down on that one. And then, you know, for those, there are many teachers, I feel, that may or may not be as perfect as, you know, they may not be as perfect as they like to present themselves. Or maybe they're in a state of consciousness temporarily while they're teaching that's heightened and not so much the rest of the time. And they may not feel that they're inclined or that it serves anything to say that. I don't know. You know, I don't. I do know that there are also individuals who, without realizing it, are still being driven by certain egoic movements, and even in their teaching. And they can look really good, but we can discern, I think, through a. This is a vibrational frequency. We recognize authenticity and truth in us because we are that. So there's a discriminating truth that we are that knows when it's the truth, and that's an issue for us. I think I think we're all learning that one. Right. I don't know if I'm making myself clear or not, but
no, definitely. Thank you.
At least for me, I'm just listening to what part of what's coming through a so-called other person that really resonates as true and what doesn't, and learning that that's the only thing I can really trust. It's not that I'm going to invest myself in any outer form or teacher. That's an error. I'm going to invest in that resonance deep inside me that knows the truth from maybe not the truth. You know? So if it's maybe not, I trust it. Maybe it's not, and I may leave that part as questionable. I had a really great teacher, sort of interim teacher in my life. He passed away last year, Rue Joy. And he used to talk about, you know, not requiring of your spiritual teachers perfection, but just learning to take from them the part that seems most true and helpful to you at that point, and appreciate the fact that on this planet thus far, most teachers are incapable of the perfection that some of us seem to want from a teacher. I mean, I heard Eckhart answering a question the other day on his, I don't know if it was in Malibu where I was there while they were filming him, or if it was on his website, about somebody that was concerned about stories about Krishnamurti's sexuality. And he said, well, he says, I don't know if he had much of that, but and I'm not quoting Eckhart here exactly, but he more or less said, why don't we just grant him that? You know? I mean, do we need for him to be perfect, or is it that we're trying to wake up to who we are?
And really, who is to, who gets to decide what perfect means?
Yeah, mostly we have an image of that, you know, and I'm not sure what it is at all. I'm more concerned with us, all of us, being willing to look, and I try to model that. Let's look ourselves at the egoic, judging, analyzing, separating movements that are still occurring in us. Let's look with great compassion and mercy. We didn't decide to condition ourselves. We were born onto a planet that's mostly crazy, and everyone's been operating based upon these egoic perceptions. So if you were born on Earth, you were pretty much guaranteed to be conditioned by this stuff. There's no need to judge ourselves for it. It's just that the only way we're going to wake up from it is by being willing to notice it. And then as regards others, whether they're spiritual teachers or, you know, the Circle K clerk, the only answer is there, but for the grace of God go I, if their behavior appears distorted. There's no reason to judge or hate them. They're still caught in unconsciousness, that's all.
And isn't it true that some of the best teachers are not those people who write books or get on TV or stand up at the front of a room, but they are the person who is acting inappropriately, and we have to find a way
to
deal with them.
That's right. I mean, it turns out that at certain stages of our growth, our enemies are our greatest teachers, what we perceive to be the enemies, because they're simply reflecting unconscious places that still remain in us. And until we find them in us and be present to those in a merciful way, then those structures within us will not be dissolved. So they're really actually helping us wake up. Of course, you know, in the moment, in these early stages, that's not necessarily the first perception that arises. We have to work our way back to that. It's also true that there are, you know, quite a number of, you know, important teachers on the positive side, people that are streaming forth very high-frequency awakening energy that are not necessarily either in a teacher role or they're in a role that's not in the public eye. I recently met a guy through the Internet that's name is Joseph Naft, and he has a website called Inner Frontiers, and I got on there, and the clarity and of the message and the purity of the intention moved me so deeply that I contacted him and have set up some telephone consultation and interaction with him. You know, wherever I can find something that, you know, that the depth of me resonates with is where I'm going to go to, and they don't have to be big stars in the world. A lot of them are not. Not to mention the fact that they can just be the guy on the street if you're aware enough to notice it. Not everybody is interested in any kind of formal teaching at all.
Beautiful.
They just be expressing from a pure place, don't you think?
Definitely, definitely. I think when I was saying, you know, who are we to say what perfection is, what came to me after that is the closest thing I think we can get to perfection is just love.
You know, that's the one thing. That's my fallback, Marie. I cannot claim, and I never know when an egoic movement may occur in me. I was fortunate that the early experience awakened to this sort of merciful aspect of consciousness in me. And if we've suffered at all, you know, I think, you know, love as it gets expressed through form in this world is really consciousness that has suffered and awakened from the suffering and is now experienced, so to speak. That's my way of thinking of it. It now knows what suffering is like. And so if we just could remember the times that we've suffered, when we're interacting with one another. Not that we want to, you know, focus on our suffering, but just remember, because that gives birth to compassion and mercy pretty quickly.
Beautiful. Well, I want to put the number out there. We are speaking with Reverend Mark Pope. He is the minister at the Unity Church in Sedona, Arizona, and we've been talking about his background and his ideas on awakening. And if you have a question you'd like to get on the air, the number to call is 1-347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. So, Mark, when with your situation of, I guess I'll call it awakening for lack of a better word, you were in such a dramatic situation. It was really do or die for you. But what about the rest of us who are just daily living our lives?
That is part of the predicament, is that it's so much easier to remain in a degree of denial when our circumstance is relatively comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain grace in the fact that all choices and possibilities of freedom were taken away, except one for me in jail, and that was inner work. That was the only door left open. So it narrowed my focus down, and the motivation then could be so much more clearly focused. Even I have had trouble time and again finding that same level of motivation to look even more deeply at times. I will say this, to be as pointed as I possibly can, and I mean this as mercifully as anyone can imagine. I feel that we are presently in a time where the old egoic structures are dissolving, and we may not can imagine what's, you know, the shift that we're undergoing right now and what it may turn out to be like at all. But the idea that there's anything to count on in this world is going to be taken away little by little anyway. I mean, a little bit of wisdom now, looking now and seeing that we cannot afford to invest our energy and our attention on either things or thoughts, which are the foundation of things, belief systems. I mean, the differences between religions are often really egoic. So I said to you laughingly, I think, before we went on the air that, you know, one of my perceptions is, if it moves, that's not it. And so there's only one thing that doesn't move, and it's not a thing. It's the presence and the awareness and the love that is already our being. And it's always already been right here. And so every spiritual teacher, whether it's Jesus or Buddha or anyone else, has tried to make this point for humanity. And we're at the juncture now where, if we don't know this, it can get very difficult for us. So turning now and realizing that the present, our presence is always here. You know, one thing I know from my experience is that we're not the body and we're not the personality structure, and death doesn't really mean anything very important. I mean, that's been clear to me since then. I mean, I was no longer, the consciousness was located outside the body, and it's clear that's not what I am. And it's not what any of us are. The body will pass, the personality undergoes changes, thoughts come and go, emotions come and go, sensations come and go, perceptions come and go, spiritual experiences come and go. People, places, and things rapidly undergo change. So the distinction that needs to be made is look and see, you know, what's not changing. And the truth is, the I am presence, the words, not the words, but this presence that the word I am stands for and points to, is the one thing that's never changed. We've always already been here. We cannot ever remember not being here. And this presence, if we feel up underneath the thoughts and the motions and the various moving experiences, is already peace, and it's already presence, and it's already a joy. And there's certitude and confidence only there and nowhere else. And that's what Jesus tried to say when he said, seek first the kingdom. And it's what all other teachers that have awakened have tried to remind us mercifully, so that we don't continue to invest in things that pass. So that kind of looking can be helpful when we really look and see. No, husbands don't last. Wives don't last. At the very most, they stay and love us a while, but they die or leave. Jobs don't last. Nothing lasts. So, you know, we don't want to wait till we're on the deathbed to wake up to this. It's just a simple discernment of looking and seeing that, I think, that can become our motivation for finally listening to these awakened teachers that have arisen amongst us and really learn to be present and let ourselves remember that who and what we are has always already been here. It's not found in something. It's not found even in the law of attraction, although that law holds true. Chasing the ability to manifest my life the way I want it is also, in my view, not the present spiritual calling. Manifestation will take care of itself just fine when we're living out of the presence of joy and grace and peace. And if we're moved to participate in bringing something forth, then we'll do so, and it'll be nearly effortless. So in the so-called spiritual community, my view is that we really need to be careful about this idea that we're going to manifest a new earth when we haven't yet awakened ourselves to who we really are. Otherwise, it's the ego that's manifesting what it wants with some kind of an idea that it's going to complete itself or save itself or make things the way it wants them to be. And that just never worked. It hasn't worked for anyone ever, and it's not going to work now. First, I think the priority needs to be remembering who we are. It's Scripture says, return unto me, and I will return unto thee. And my feeling is humanity is on the return movement and is called to return. Now, there's no returning because, in essence, it's already here, and there's no me. But these are just pointers. This is like consciousness saying, remember your essence. Wake up and remember who you are. Remember what matters. Being kind right now to yourself and others, remembering that everyone around you is an expression of the same presence, doing the best they can, and doing your work in you rather than too much concern for organizing and micromanaging the world of form. Those things can help us be motivated when we finally really hear and see that. Maybe all we do is decide to spend 15 more minutes a day consciously breathing or in meditation, in stillness. And most spiritual teachers will say if just that little bit will radically change everything.
So, Mark, I'm just listening. I'm hearing what you're saying about, you know, how we are not our egos and we are not these physical bodies that we're in. We're so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we are here living this experience in these meat mm-hmm. suits.
Right.
And living within the constraints of the ego. So where is the balance between being in the present moment, and yes, that is so important, and realizing that death is not as important as we sometimes think it is. And at the same time, I mean, we must be here for a purpose in this living, you know.
Yeah, we're here to do something besides contemplate our belly button, so to speak. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I agree. I mean, we are the meeting place. Each of us is where the formless, invisible presence is expressing itself as form. That's what we are, the form, the form that is expressing it. And I guess I'm just called to emphasize the formless, because there's so much emphasis on how to make the world of form work out. And if I look around at what I see happening, even within, you know, the early stage spiritual development of many of us, we're not spending very much time paying attention to the formless, eternal nature. We're often excited about how I can go co-create my future. And that may be another ego seduction in many cases. And that's fine. I mean, if we need to go check that out. However, nothing in the world of form resolves this fundamental issue. So I'm saying, I guess, that I think that space, stillness, silence, being consciously present is the primary calling that I am moved to make as a spiritual teacher, to say, you know, be still. Take time to become acquainted with this essence. Feel it. Because at that point, we do have, Unity talks about divine ideas, and by that term, they mean ideas that rise directly out of the source. And when those ideas arise, they arise with enormous confidence. They don't arise with worry or doubt, and they don't make us have to look over our shoulder to see if it's working. They come up as if we know they're already done, in a way. And then we cooperate with them as we recently decided to create a peace chapel. It's just a meditation space at the church with a large gilded lettered image at the back of it that says, "Peace, be still." Well, no, that's a manifestation in form. And yet, you know, we didn't really run out there and try to raise funds for it at all. We just mentioned that we were going to do it, and so many people felt attuned to it that the money was all offered to us before we ever had to even invite people to contribute to it. And when ideas are emerging from source, that's how I think manifestation occurs. So I'm not trying to belittle or discount the laws of manifestation. It's simply, you know, who's doing the manifesting is the question. Is it rising really from source? Because if it is, there's nothing to get worried about or concerned about. Sit still until you feel that movement, and then participate with it and trust it, and watch it flow into place. That's how. And as far as our purpose in the world, I do know that we, you know, so many people are, for example, undergoing financial contractions and losses right now, and there's concern for how am I going to feed myself and pay my rent. And I think that the losses themselves are really rising as opportunities for us to shift the field of our intention back to what I'm saying. And just be still. When something disappears, sit still in that empty space and see what the infinite field of our being wants to bring forth in it. And then when it rises with great power. It's a subtle power, and it carries the energy of mercy and love and goodness, and it's never just to serve me and what I think I need. It's always something that is larger than that. It serves life. Is that a fair response, sir, to your question? Am I hearing
yes.
the question well
no,
enough.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
And I, when you are serving life, when you're serving more than just yourself, it feels so much fuller. You get that satisfaction, whereas when we're just trying to get for ourselves, it's always...
Yeah, I mean, when you asked that question, I had the feeling that the intention of your question was to serve your listening audience. I felt that you were asking the question because you were imagining that some of the listening audience might have that question. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely.
So, see, you were in that field right then. That was the divine idea. That question arose out of the field as a form of service.
Beautiful. Well, it feels good to ask it, and your question was, your answer was amazing. Thank you so much. So, Mark, we just have a few minutes left in the show, and I'm wondering if there's any tips or anything that you feel it really needs to be said that hasn't been asked about yet.
I think to summarize that if out of great mercy, my suggestion to any of us that are listening is to take a little more time in the stillness and silence and trust that it is the source and it will provide the guidance, the divine ideas that need to be followed. It will emerge as a supporting, sustaining manifestation in form. And it will also provide us, even more importantly, the sense of underlying peace that remains with us no matter what happens in the world of form.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for being of such wonderful service to the Namaste audience today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, Maria, it is so much my pleasure. I really appreciate you as well. I can sense the purity of your intention in this work, and I'm so glad you're there doing this work.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm glad that this show brought us together, because actually I had Reverend Julie Montague on another show I host, and she had mentioned you. So when Constance told me about you, I was like, jumped at the chance to have you on the show.
I haven't talked to Julie in years, but I had spoken in her church and I know her well, so I will thank her for making that reference and giving me the opportunity to serve. And
wonderful.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you so much. And if people want to contact
Constance
you
as well. Well, you know, them. I'm at Unity of Sedona. We're in the middle of shifting our website. It's up, and you can always contact us that way. The phone number is, of course, can be easily accessed on the website, and then soon there will be a website with video on it, in which we offer our teachings in that way as well in about another 30 days. So,
wonderful.
And
so
we're going to continue to be related, I think, to you guys at Namaste in any way we can. So I'm sure we will continue to be of support to one another as time unfolds here.
Definitely. Well, I look forward to engaging with you again. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you, Marie.
Take care, Reverend Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was Reverend Mark Pope. He is the minister at the Unity Church in Sedona, Arizona. Such wonderful, inspiring words. I hope that it will leave you feeling a little more present and a little more still in this moment this evening. I hope that it carries on throughout your evening and into the rest of your week. Thank you so much for being with us. Have a wonderful evening. Again, please join us at namastepublishing.com if you'd like to have further conversations about these topics. Take care. Be well. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend. favorite this show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.